Did either of you guys see Star Wars in theaters?
Yeah. You mean the originals?
Or do you mean like read the book or something?
No, no. Opening day.
Were you old enough?
I wasn't born, but
1977.
Yeah, I wasn't.
I graduated that year.
Wow.
I was at opening day on the second one.
That's why I'm a senior citizen.
Oh no.
I would have been there, but I wasn't born
yet. You were there in spirit.
I snuck into the third one for free.
Oh no.
Underneath someone's Jedi robe or what?
You did not see an extra person in the theater.
So what's with the Civil War coat, Cash?
He came with the company.
It's not. It's a Swiss
Army?
Miss.
Swiss Army.
Swiss Miss.
And it is incredibly comfortable. Incredibly and warm and incredibly comfortable.
All sorts of shit folds out of the pockets.
What the hell? Do I want to know?
Swiss Army.
The only problem is it's wool and it smells like wool.
Do the buttons double as knives or anything like that?
No, but there's a fork in the cuff.
How come I don't get one of those things?
Did you see the Swiss Army knife stamp tongs?
What's it?
No.
They had like Swiss Army knife stamp tongs.
Was a loop fold out of them?
No, but a little magnifying glass comes out of them.
Does it hold fluid?
It just has like
my favorite Martian.
Four little things that pop out of it. Of course, one of them is stamp tongs.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, podcast number 13. I'm sitting here with Scott, Cash, Tom, Steve, Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes and Stitcher. So let's talk about stamps. So this week we'll be talking about stamp news, the Marilyn Monroe auction, stamp collecting history, Frederick Douglass, updates, stamp stories, Star Wars, and our expert topic of the week is color varieties and controversy. So stamp news, on December 6, 2014, Julian's Auction, Beverly Hills, is holding an auction of property from the personal and professional life of Marilyn Monroe. 33 pages of this auction catalog are dedicated to letters including a, quote, heartbreaking letter to Marilyn from her soon-to-be ex-husband, Joe DiMaggio. It was written just after Monroe's press conference announcing the couple's divorce. DiMaggio writes about watching the press conference on television. It is clear in the letter that the baseball superstar did not want their marriage to end, and he asked Monroe to reconsider. There are also fan letters, postcards, financial documents, telegraphs, celebrity letters are among the list. What's interesting is she kept the entirety of the letter, the cover, the pictures, photographs.
So somebody could make a Marilyn Monroe exhibit for a stamp show.
She was in Hollywood. It's all about being a star.
Yep.
Everything you touch is collectible or something you save.
Especially a letter like that.
There are lots of air mails because she got mail from around the world. Special deliveries. A couple of interesting coils. What stamps do you guys know that she appeared on? I know Cash is a favorite.
There's a lot of eye rolling right now.
2967.
Yes, I... bring that up at a later show date when we switch to a PG-13 podcast.
Oh, there we go.
Oh, instead of just the regular 13?
No, it's her centerfold one on a stamp.
I think it's interesting that they even went to auction. I mean, ephemera.
Well, somebody wants the money. Contest.
Yeah, that's the point. Somebody wants money.
Yeah.
They even put up her like bills and stuff, though.
Well, but how long ago did she die?
60s.
I thought it was like 63 or something. 63?
Yeah, I would have said mid-60s myself.
I mean, the people who care about Marilyn Monroe are slowly but surely dying off. You know, that's one of the things that I've seen. You know, there was a big collection of stuff from Fatty Arbuckle, who was the guy at the time who probably, you know, we're historians here at the podcast, but, you know, most of the outside world doesn't have any clue who he is, and that really diminishes the value of the items. So, you know, it's time to hit the market with this stuff.
Okay, moving on.
Nothing else? Aw. Marilyn Monroe, she was like the sexiest woman alive.
Oh, until she died.
I would almost say that the letter from Joe DiMaggio would just as likely go to a sports collector as it would to a stamp collector.
Probably. Ooh, true. Yeah,
you get or some interesting Hollywood fights. Collector.
Yeah, I like cross collectibles like this. It's, you know, has the provenance and it's stamped. It's like
I think the stamps are probably the least of the impetus for collecting some of those things. Yeah, the least significant aspect.
Yeah, I don't think a stamp collector is going to outbid a Marilyn Monroe collector.
No, usually those people have pretty deep pockets.
Yeah.
Hey, I'll tell somebody, I'll go halves with you. I keep the cover, you keep the letter, and we'll call it even.
Okay, stamp collecting history. On December 3rd, 1847, Frederick Douglass publishes the first issue of his newspaper, North Star. That was an anti-slavery newspaper which ran from December 1847 to June 1851. The first U.S. stamp on which he appeared is a 25-cent Scott number 1290, which began production in 1965 and had a long run, finally ending in November 24, 1986. This stamp is the focus of an investigation found in the November 2014 volume of the United States Specialist in an article titled Regulatory Ink Change and an Unrecognized Color Variety, the 25-cent Frederick Douglass Definitive by Charles Neihart, which we'll be referencing later in this discussion on color varieties. So what updates do we have today? I think Cash wants to start off with his...
Yeah, I have an update.
No,
I want to apologize to all the Zoroastrians out there because in the last podcast I said you were fire worshippers. I looked it up. I understand totally. You do not worship fire. You have God just like everybody else, but your symbol is fire and you understand my mistake. In addition to that, I've got a chicken stamp. I got the DuPont, the chicken stamp sheet from the DuPont collection. So I have...
Does it lay golden eggs?
Yeah.
It was DuPont, so yes.
There you go.
Okay, I'm going to take this time to introduce our guest today, Mr. Steve Patillo of Quality Stamp Shows, who is the inspiration for our podcast name. So what's going on in your neck of the woods?
Hello. We have Orco Expo coming up in January 9 through 11, which is the 40th anniversary of one of the largest events in the country. It will be held at the Embassy Suites. It's called Anaheim South. However, it is actually in Garden Grove. It will be 3 days open to the public from 10 till 4 on Friday and Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sunday. It will have a bourse of approximately 50 vendors and an auction conducted by Regency Superior. And it's the place to be that particular weekend if you're hunting and looking for stamps to buy and sell and have a good time.
I believe you said 10 to 4 on Friday and Saturday and 10 to 6 on Sunday. It's the other way
you're
around.
You're right. Correct. It's 10 to 6 on Friday and Saturday and 10 to 4 on Sunday.
You can edit that, don't worry.
And for all those who may want to travel to Southern California in the middle of winter, it's right down the road from Disneyland. So bring your family.
And middle of winter in Anaheim in January is typically in the high 70s, low 80s. So come on and get your beach on.
Yep. Bring your swimming trunks.
Yes.
Well, it's raining today, so.
No, I've said in January, though.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it gets... the weather gets better as it goes through winter.
Typically,
well,
we're...
Well, we only have about one rainstorm a year.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so stamp stars, we're going to talk about Star Wars. Please insert your favorite Star Wars theme music here. It's playing in my head right now. It's
Oh, come on, you're all wrong. It's the Cantina song.
So,
I'd like to get someone to do it.
Well, you know, Cash is gullible. Of course, so, you can get him to do it.
It's time to let my geek flag fly yet again. So, how many times did you guys watch the new Star Wars trailer, including the parodies?
70 billion.
Including the parodies, a lot.
There's some good parodies out there.
There are some great parodies.
I like the Disney parody the best. Hey, that was a pun, and I didn't even realize it.
So why are we bringing up Star Wars?
Okay. So the movie's been released. There's a lot of hype right now. So I was looking for anything related to Star Wars and stamps that was new. And I came across that Topps is actually releasing a Star Wars Masterwork trading cards. So what do trading cards have to do with stamps? Well, in their infinite wisdom, they are including something called a relic. And they're going to be called stamp relics. And it's the actual United States postage kind of enclosed inside these cards or encased. I can't quite tell in the picture.
It's encapsulated.
Yeah, face it. There we go.
They're encapsulated.
If the people know about Topps in the past, they have encapsulated. They had, like, I think it was somebody's hair that they put in one. They put a piece of a jersey in another one. What are some other things that they put on their cards?
You're right. Lots of them.
Yeah, lots of stuff. And then, of course, they've had autographs for a very long time. But this one has a stamp.
I think it was Joe Montana's jersey.
I think you're right.
It's at least one stamp they've released, but it's probably a lot of them, I think. There's been more than
and
one.
And the hair was off of Terry Bradshaw. Ha ha.
Enough of that.
Well, are you going to put this on the website?
Yeah, I'll put a link.
Yeah, because the one that you show a picture of is the, what was it, 32 cent, right?
41.
41 cent with Princess Leia putting the Death Star plans into R2-D2, the
that
little red stamp.
Obi-Wan Kenobi?
This is an actual card that you...
Yeah, that's the card.
Oh. Yeah, so the card will look like, eh, it looks kind of cool.
Yeah, it's nice looking.
So the question would be, are they going to do the whole sheet?
I cannot see them doing one stamp. However, from a size standpoint, they're probably it would be interesting because, you know, the Darth Vader stamp is really big.
But that would be the only one that I would really want.
Yeah, that's but it's a huge stamp.
I know. You and everybody else.
Yeah, everybody's going to look for Darth Vader.
So they got to do it.
And nobody wants Princess Amidala or whatever her name
is. Who said that? Nobody wants Yoda.
No, Yoda. Yoda would probably be popular.
Yeah.
I think he would be.
Yoda should be very popular.
Yo.
I forget. Was Boba Fett on that sheet?
Yes, he was.
Yep. Oh, forget it. Yeah. He's gone.
And they had the Millennium Falcon and X-Wing and a Y-Wing and a...
Yeah, what if they do international stamps, too? There's a lot of those.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That'd be cool.
We had a poster of that Star Wars sheet, if we could ever find it. It's around here somewhere.
Yeah.
Not a poster.
I gave you a bunch of them.
What's it called?
A poster.
A glissé.
There we go.
No, it's a giclée.
A giclée. God, I can't even pronounce it correctly.
Your own long-standing pun.
Yeah. No, it's floating around here somewhere, and we could name off all the guys, but it's better to access your nerdy side and try to remember them all.
It's going to be released December 17, that they're currently pre-sales on eBay and the actual website. So the cost of the ticket, I want to say, lottery ticket to get this particular card. For 20 cards, it's $250, which equals about, what, $11 some odd cents per card?
How much is it for how many?
20 for $250.
$12.50
a piece, yeah.
There we go.
Hold on. So it's going to be a card pack.
Yeah.
A very expensive.
It's like a mini
pack.
Box. It's not a foil pack. It's like a little box.
Are they going to have cards along with it? I mean, these are like obviously the chase cards. Are they going to have a normal set that goes with it?
Yeah, there's like defining moments, artwork.
But those will be
sketches.
Those will be the chase cards. No,
maybe.
They're going to be up. The stamps are going to be up there with up in rarity.
I like they call them stamp relics.
Yes.
I mean, you know they stole this from World of Warcraft.
Oh.
You know they had to have. Chasing relics and stuff.
Oh,
well,
dear.
20 cards for $250, you can definitely tell Disney bought Star Wars.
Yeah. Yeah.
As pin collectors, we don't bat an eye at that, because that's how much a 20-pin collector set would cost. So we're just
exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Okay. On the website, though, people are complaining up and down, that's too much.
Soak the nerds.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, here it says, basic set will consist of 75 cards. and there will be three 10-card insert sets. So that'll mean there's 105 cards, there's a 75-card set, and then you have 30 chase cards along with it.
But you also have, I think it says over here that there's like different kinds of sets as well. There's like a silver set and a gold set.
I love the name of this one company. Companions and Scum and Villainy Cards. Boy, that's a tongue twister even just to say it.
They'll be out of business with a name like that.
Yeah. They're not a lawyer firm.
There you go.
I will definitely be hitting them up, trying to get them on eBay, but...
I would like to get one, but I don't know, you know, I find one for $12.50, I don't know if I'd buy one.
Just make sure if
you find... It's a lot of lunches.
Just make sure if you find one on eBay that you're not bidding against a friend or something for it.
Oh, okay, yeah. I'll double check who I'm bidding against. But here's a really good question. Do you think it's going to be a stamp collectible? Do you think you'll see them at stamp shows?
Typically, novelty items in the stamp business have never gone over. However, it is Star Wars, so it has a chance, but it's going to be limited. Your traditional collectors probably will scoff and turn their head and go buy older stamps. And if there are kids at the show, of course they'd probably want one, but that's the next challenge, getting kids to the shows.
I kind of disagree with that, because the older classic collector is usually the person who grew up with Star Wars. I mean, it is in their age range.
But do they connect that with classic stamps that they collect?
Other than the stamps, I've never bought a Star Wars collectible.
Mm. Well, not only that, to me, the problem is it's not a new stamp. They repurposed an old stamp.
That is, yeah.
I have the sheet. I like the sheet. Why would I just want one single thing out of it? Not saying I personally wouldn't get it, but just that's a problem that I see.
I find it curious why they would even connect stamps with it.
Yeah, that was kind of odd. It seemed kind of...
I think they were just looking for something that they could get inexpensively to kind of
boost their sales. The artwork's already out there.
Yeah.
It's public domain.
But if they use the stamp, they don't have to pay the Postal Service royalties for using those images.
I think it's a good introductory collectible. People would be like, this is a Star Wars stamp. Where can I get more Star Wars stamps?
And also, from a business standpoint, they probably went up to the post office and said, you know, we're going to use these stamps. And the post office probably said, oh, yes, thank you very much for using our stamps. Yes.
Yeah, because they'll never be used on a letter.
They're actually using the stamps?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's an actual stamp that's put inside of a encapsulation on the top card. Goody.
That will push up the market on the remainers.
Oh, yeah, sure. The
people buying them to counterfeit the cards.
The 200 sheets they're going to buy or 2,000 sheets.
How
many cards
are they going to do? They'll probably do, for a chase set, probably 2,500. I would expect it would be probably about that.
I would expect more. But
might be as high as 10,000, but it depends on how popular it is.
You remove 10,000 sheets, that's why a small dent.
And if you're looking for something in the meantime, the USPS website still offers the first day cancels of the 2007 Star Wars stamps. You can still buy it on their website.
They're not making any more. They're just selling the ones they already made.
They're still selling those.
Well, let me reword that. They didn't burn the ones that they made.
That's a good topic. I really
stamp disagree. Burning?
Yeah, they destroy stamps regularly. They've already printed them. Why don't they just sell them?
Did he already make an apology to that?
But what about the Zep set? They printed what? I forget what it was. There was a huge number of Zep stamps.
60,000.
No, I think it was 50,000.
That's how many were sold. They printed...
I think it was 150,000?
Something like that, yeah. And they ended up burning like...
Two-thirds of it.
More than two-thirds, yeah. So, I mean...
Ridiculous.
Well, in the old days, and again, you know, this is like from Pat's... What is it?
Paragraphs.
Pat's Paragraphs. They were talking about you could buy a $5 Colombian until the 1920s. They still had them in post offices.
And during the Depression, below face.
Yeah.
I mean, wasn't that some of the worry with the new inverted Jenny sheets, that there's supposed to be 100 of the collectible ones out there? What if they stop selling them and just destroy the rest of them?
At some point, they probably will. And I think it's bad for them to do that. They should just leave it on sale until they all sell out.
That was their intention. Leave it on sale, sell it out till they're gone. Just like Willy Wonka's candy bar.
So you don't think they will eventually pull it?
The information I've been getting from various post offices, they're out or they sent some back. And some of them say, hey, well, those are getting destroyed. Which is contrary to what the whole purpose was.
I think they'll sell them forever.
I hope so.
They may take them out of the post office and just list them all online.
Yeah.
I mean, if you can still buy the 2007 Star Wars stamp online.
Yeah,
that's true. That's a good point. They got some 7 years old still for sale.
I mean, you know, people are banking on the hope that they'll burn them, because then there's only 20 sheets out there or whatever, however many are out there. But the
that would be big stamp news. Ooh.
Then that would create a new monster.
Well, you've already created scarcity because you only have 100 of them out there.
They already pissed off a bunch of people, and they're going to piss them off again.
Well, who knows?
Yeah, all the ones who already sold their sheets before the rest were destroyed.
Wouldn't be the first time.
We're talking a government agency, you guys.
they do that on a daily basis.
You mean if it works, they're fixing it.
If it makes sense, then that's got to go.
Well, the other question, too, is if Scott's lists it inside of the Scott's catalog, then the post office has an incentive to keep it up there for a long time. If Scott's catalog puts it as a footnote, then there may not be the interest in the post office to carry it for that long.
Okay, tell us what your favorite Star Wars stamp is on our Facebook or Twitter feed and keep the conversation going online. So our expert topic this week is color. So I'm going to ask you guys, where do color shades come from?
Well, they come from lots of different places.
What's your favorite?
What's your favorite place? Well, I like the place down the street.
The windowsill.
Yeah.
Deep reddish violet.
No. Well, I collect 1851 to 1859 stamps. I collect a lot of the 3-cent Washington stamp. And where those shades came from was you had different different suppliers supplying different pigments from different places. Everything was mixed by hand. So if a person accidentally put a scoop and a half of one color in instead of a scoop and a half of another color, you'd get a different shade. Or if they didn't put enough oil in, or if they put too much oil in, or if they put too much water in, or if they didn't put enough. Or if it was late in the day and it was a humid day, or if it was a hot day and the ink dried quickly. So you have a strip of 10, and from the top is a vertical strip, and from the top to the bottom, the stamps change color because of the application of the ink to the printing plates. So in the 1851 to 1857 issue, the 3-cent imperf, that's one of the places where shades come from.
A lot of times it's the intensity of the ink, and you see that in issues like Scott number 64, the 3-cent rose, or the 3-cent pink and 3-cent rose. And the pigeon blood pink is just a more intense shade of the pink.
I
always thought of it as special printing almost.
Well, there's the theory on this, and this is from the White's catalog, is that in August 1861, all of them were pigeon blood pink. And the difference between a pigeon blood pink and a number 65 is how the stamp was stored, what envelope it was put on, what was the acid content of the envelope, because what made the pigeon blood pink,
I think it went back to the pigmentation of how they mixed it again.
Yeah, it had a yellow pigment to it, and it had a lavender pigment to it, and basically the yellow goes away from sunlight or ultraviolet rays, and the lavender goes away with sulfuration and acid.
Well, another thing is, I mean, if it's a cloudy day out, your vision, your perception of color is also different. So you could be mixing the ink to a recipe, and you can mix it differently because it's more or less light outside.
Well, that happened, again, the 1851 to 1857 issue. Stamps that were printed late in the evening tended to be lighter because you were mixing it by candlelight. And this is not from documentation from the stamp printers. This is from documentation of the other printers that at nighttime they had to really take care because their daytime inks and their nighttime inks were mixed differently because of, you know, the candlelight they were using or the tallow or whatever they were. They weren't using candles at that point. They were using oil lamps. But, you know, the light you were using affected what you thought the picture or the color was.
Now, with modern inks, a lot of times there's a lot of photogravure and lithographic printing nowadays. And the color variations you see now a lot of times are with just varying intensities of the ink. When it prints more or less ink, you have, since you're using small dots of color and the intensity and combination of those is reflects what your eye is going to pick up. Normally you don't print, you only print four colors. And all of the colors that we perceive with our eyes can be made broken down into those four colors. And so it makes it very, the color can change depending on the intensity of any one of those inks.
So what's with all the weird names?
They get them from women.
Says the woman who
lipstick. And
what types of colors are you wearing on your nails right now?
Yeah,
and what's on your lips?
I am currently wearing ruby red lipstick. I think I make a good color expert because I have. I don't know, Jeff.
How many? She's got lipsticks? A lot of shades at home.
Shades of orange
and nail polishes. And...
But do you have pigeon blood pink?
Ooh, I do.
Pigeon blood pink. You wear pigeon blood pink lipstick?
Can't you tell?
Only on Halloween.
Oh, I saw his tongs, and
the tongs come into play.
Yeah, pretty amazing.
My tongs have the shade of color that is towards the pigeon blood pink or deep brush violet, and it has. Can you see the blue or purple in it? The aura of it?
Yeah, yes. This is an audio podcast. We can see that.
hold it up to the microphone closer.
Here you go. Now, this color resonates at a decibel of.
No, two pairs. We're talking a lot about pigeon blood pink, and one of the things that is a ongoing project with me and another person named Steve Rosen, who is a collector in the local area. A lot of the early Scott's catalog colors were described from the Ridgway color guide. And Ridgway was an ornithologist, and he picked colors and painted them into swatches and put them in a book so that when you observed a bird, you could describe what color the bird's feathers were. So when we have pigeon blood pink, we have that name because it comes from the Ridgway guide for somewhere he saw a dead pigeon, and he matched up the pigeon blood pink, put it in his compendium, and published it to the bird watchers. There are a couple of them that we're working on because, again, you know, my 1851 to 1859 collection. We're converting a lot of the colors like Corinthian red and Etruscan red and deep yellowish red and things like these. We're converting from Ridgway to Pantone. And Pantone is a color guide that people should be familiar with because if you use a computer, you're using Pantone colors. Half of the paint made in the country is used with Pantone colors now. So it's a fairly well-accepted gauge, and it uses kind of neat names and stuff like that, but it's easy to get a color sample from Pantone. You can literally pull it up on the internet versus a Ridgway color, which there are very few Ridgway guides available. They're over 100 years old, and you hope that they are still the same color as when they were made.
So has the Pantone been accepted in philately yet?
No, we're still working with bird feather colors.
Okay.
But as time goes by, hopefully, Scott's catalog, And I don't expect it really to happen. There is going to have to be some sort of conversion guide. Because
makes sense.
Scott's is never going to change pigeon blood pink to another color, because pigeon blood pink is just a classic in the stamp market. Plum, pink, you know, these colors. No,
but the Pantone system has a 4-digit number, 3 or 4-digit number that goes along
and a letter.
And that goes along with each color description and variation.
Pigeon blood pink would turn like an A1495.
Yeah, something like that. Mm-hmm. And that's something you wouldn't necessarily need as much of a cross-reference. All they'd have to do is add that to the color description in the catalog.
That makes sense.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, is the Pantone color guide based upon spectral analysis?
No, it is based on the combination of colors that make the color.
Okay.
So it's actually a breakdown of the recipe that creates that color.
And consistent usage of those components to make that color.
If right. you have a, I forget what they call the blue, but if you have
cyan,
if you have a standardized cyan color and you have a recognized magenta color, and the two of them, well, these are the two that they use. They use cyan and magenta. And if Pantone number 126B is 62% of this one and the rest of it is that one, that's the color. And it's going to be consistent forever.
I believe in standardization. It's just bringing it about that's the difficulty.
Oh, of course.
Well, and the hard part for me is, you know, you say it's based off of bird feathers, the original colors. Because when I see something like a stamp that says it's plum, no plum I've ever seen in my life looks that color.
U.S. number 11 plum, for those of you who are out there who have never seen one, what the real color is if you ever go to the beach and the water washes up on the sand, and then when it washes out, the sand gets like that dark brown shade, that's the color of plum in the Ridgeway.
Yeah, not so much.
And if I saw a real plum like that, I'd throw it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Defective plum.
So plum in Ridgeway is like the color of wet beach sand. But if you use a Pantone guide, it's going to be, you know, brownish yellow number or 20. Or actually, excuse me, because we'll get into this the other stuff. It'll be yellowish brown number 415 or something. And in the Book of Secrets, we did this for 279Bs, and we have the Pantone colors. So now, you know, it says Carmen. You look it up. We give you the range of Pantone colors. You, if it's a BC, a Rose Carmen.
Well, I thought that was due to the, what, it fluoresced?
We're getting into more technical side of it.
Okay.
But that's a side of, yeah, I know. I did.
This is the expert section.
A way to tell.
Yeah. So it's another way of confirming, because when you put it under fluorescent light, you can tell what type of ink they printed with. And if it's an aniline ink, it glows, and if it's a non-aniline ink, it doesn't glow. And typically, well, here's a perfect example, is we have these two colors, and we call, one of them is rose carmine, and the other one we call pinkish carmine. They're both the same color.
In normal light.
You put it under fluorescent light, one glows because it's aniline ink.
Fluorescent light, it's ultraviolet light.
Excuse me, ultraviolet light. One glows because it's aniline ink, and the other one doesn't glow. They're both 279 BCs, totally different ink mixtures. And that's one that we were going to speak about, right?
What was the other one? That's a good lead-in to the Frederick Douglass stamp that they
did.
They did the color analysis in 1980 that they had regulatory changes to the law to eliminate heavy metals from the ink mixtures, the ink recipes.
Don't eat your stamps.
They had to reformulate all the inks, and they had to try and match them to the pre-1980 colors. And with the 20-cent Marshall and now the 25-cent Frederick Douglass, they matched it, but not exactly. Now, Scott also... Scott does list the post-1980 Marshall stamp as a slightly different shade. And the article in the United States Specialist, which is published by the United States Stamp Society, that goes into detail, and it shows they analyze different plate blocks, and they can tell when those plate when those printing plates went to press. And so they're able to tell that, okay, this should be this ink, and this should be the reformulated ink. And they were able to consistently show that these have different spectral analysis. And so they can confirm that they're different inks, and they are slightly different shades. And when you look at them side by side, it's really slight, but the difference in the shade is there. And they're trying to argue for a new listing of a color shade.
So there would be five varieties, which I agree upon because I found it.
Well, it's very, very slight, and it's not as there's not as much a difference in the shade as there are on older, more classic shade varieties. So it's something that's not
subtlety.
It's very subtle, and you have to decide where do you draw the line.
So
even though you can prove that it is reformulated ink or a different
then
formula,
it's a variety.
It is, but if it takes very, very expensive scientific equipment to be able to confirm or...
For sure,
then that's really not the intent of philately.
There will be a different... Go ahead.
I'm sorry, and in that article, they used three different machines. They used a very new model, VSC, that does color analysis. They did an XRF, which measures metals that they use to test the ink, non-destructive testing, to get the metal content, and then they used another machine to get to identify the organic compounds in the ink.
And all of those are extremely, incredibly expensive.
Well, that's just a crazy amount of work to identify the color.
Right now, but if it comes down to you can look at the plate number and identify it, then that's something that anybody can do.
Which they did conclude in there as well.
Right, for
or
this
go
issue,
through
but they
large
they,
quantities. And
but they went back
differences.
To the they went back to the 20-cent Marshall, and they couldn't do that because some of those plates were printed on either side of the reformulation of the ink.
If you don't have a plate number, what do you do?
That's what I
that's
was thinking.
The other,
exactly.
That's the other thing. If you don't have a plate number,
you need large quantities to say just like postage dues.
Yeah. What I did when I started out collecting, I looked in the catalog and I saw wet and dry printings for the Liberty series. And I go, how in the world do I tell these apart? So I read the catalog, and it's very important to read the catalog because the catalog gives you a lot of information. And the information in the catalog at the time gave you the plate number range for the dry printings and the Liberty series. So I went out and I bought one that was in the range and one that wasn't. I said, okay, that's the dry printing and that's the wet printing. And I looked at them side by side. I said, okay, now I understand how they look.
But how do you tell without it?
Exactly, but how do you tell without it? Now, I can tell without it now because I've taken that and I've worked with it for a number of years, and now I can recognize those even when they don't have a plate number.
What happens if you have the same plate number?
Well, but that's...
You need to know how to tell the differences. Yes.
That's right. That's right. So, but this is a very, very subtle shade, and you may or may not, depending on your lighting, you may or may not be able to tell the difference.
In which case, if you're not working with outside light, I recommend to use an Ott light.
Absolutely.
We all love Ott lights here.
Well, that's one of the things that article actually mentioned on the Frederick Douglass stamp. There are at least two plate numbers where they were in use both before and after the reformulation. So there are two plates that were after, but there were two plates that were in use during the crossover period.
Right. So you can actually find that plate number in both shade varieties. So, but can you tell without the plate number which variety it is? And I don't know if
it's subtle. It's subtle.
Yeah.
And I have noticed a difference in working with all the stock that I do, and came to the conclusion that there were five varieties, even though the catalog only lists four.
One of the main things is if Scott lists it, then collectors care.
No,
if Scott doesn't list it,
a supplement with it in the supplement, they care. But if they put it in the catalog, it could be a minor listing, which
right.
they don't care.
I think they care if it's a minor listing. If they don't list it at all, nothing.
A large percentage of collectors, and mostly beginner and intermediate level collectors, they collect by the album that they have. They don't freeform collect, and they don't collect, they don't specialize. And so if that shade or that variation is not given a space in the album, most of those people are not going to go and add a stamp to the page because it makes the page look unbalanced, or for some other reason, it just doesn't look right to them. So they're not going to go do that. And a lot of times they don't even care. You can have a tagged and an untagged variety, and they don't care which one they have because it's not something that's visually different.
Well, with the H stamps that came out, how many I haven't seen a Scott's catalog in a while for it, but do they list all the little varieties of the H stamp?
I mean the local Oscom and
the subtle differences? And, yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I was looking at a stamp yesterday that the date is 1.4 millimeters and the variety is 1.55 millimeters. Oh, my God. Okay, but I stock those things because if you have a Lighthouse album, they show all varieties, major and minor. So I go out of my way to chase down all the little nuances.
Yep.
But then again, that album is probably not, especially for a beginner collector.
No, it's for an advanced
collector. It's for an advanced collector.
But if you are not an advanced collector and you just want a nice hingeless album, then you have it. Now you have to be compelled to fill the spaces so that you're complete.
Right.
Well, the other thing too, though, is you know if let's say they for the Frederick Douglass stamp, they do give it a spot, and the average collector cannot determine what it is, then you're really just you have to rely on somebody else who, you know, gets the right plate number, breaks up a sheet, and says, here's the correct stamp that goes into that spot.
Well, a lot of times you see that in a lot of old time albums. They couldn't afford the stamp, so and that's where some of the old flat plate coils come from, the fakes. It's because, oh, I can't afford that stamp here. I'll snip off the perforations, well, and now I've got a ready-made coil to put in my album, so it looks great.
I understand that, but this is not something that's going to be really expensive, though.
In this case,
I can cite
they're
example.
Just going to take whatever they can get, and because they don't have the nuance, they're just going to stick it there because to them it looks the same.
Let's go back to the stamp. The common ones sell for about 50 to 75 cents. The dry variety is about a buck and a half. And if you get the magenta, it's $25. So there is a difference.
Hold on. You mean the
color variety, yeah.
The color variety on here. The color variety is like a $25 stamp.
There's already one recognized color variety for the Frederick Douglass stamp.
Which is the magenta.
Right.
Again.
And that's because it was printed in the ink. They used the wrong ink when they printed it.
I hate to ask, is it the magenta? What does the magenta look like?
It's bright. It's called a bright magenta.
Okay. So does it stand out readily from the rest of the...
If you're familiar with color, you'll recognize it. If you're not, you won't be sure.
Oh.
And then you got to go ask someone like Steve.
Ah. There you go.
We get those every once in a while.
He knows a guy.
Well, invariably every show someone comes up to me and asks, is this the one? Is this right? Do I have it? No.
Do you ever get to say yes?
Only occasionally.
Ah.
One in a million.
I did sell one of those, the magenta, last Anaheim show.
A tip to podcast listeners, go out there and buy the, let me guess, high plate numbers for the Frederick Douglass stamp?
Not sure by the numbers.
Well, for anyone who wants to verify, according to the article on there, all of the stamps, the two plate numbers that were all reformulated ink are the dull gum variety.
And that's not the right one for the magenta.
No.
The dull gum.
No, magenta is not the dull gum. But the reformulated ink,
right.
Two of the plates that were used after reformulation are only used on dull gum.
And they're not common. Although the value is low, it does not reflect the scarcity.
Also, that they when they reformulated the ink, in that time frame, similar to that, they changed from the shiny gum to the dull gum, but it wasn't at the exact same time. So some issues you can tell when they switched because the dull gum, the switch was before they went to dull gum, and some issues were in print through that time so the dull gum, shiny gum doesn't give you a clue.
Do you have these examples to put on the website?
I will by the time this podcast is live.
I tried to look them up on eBay, and there's tons of them, but you can't tell.
You can't tell shades on eBay.
Yeah. I think you just offended Steve, Jessica.
No,
eBay.
What you have to do is you have to scan them all on the same scan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You can't, because that way everything is done at the exact same time, all on the same equipment. And you'll get the
subtleties.
You'll get the subtle contrasts, and even if your monitor is adjusted differently than somebody else's monitor, you're still going to see the subtle differences by comparing.
But one not to necessarily the other. Conclusive to take a stamp up to the computer and say, "Oh, I have that one."
Correct.
Although, because if your monitor's tuned wrong, you may compare it to the other stamp.
Exactly.
So, are some of these colors outdated?
How do you mean?
Yes. Well, you know, there's like a million shades of blue. And if you get the scientific equipment we mentioned earlier and actually compare them all, they're kind of the same.
You don't need the scientific equipment. You need color samples. And that's why I love Pantone. Pantone is going to have like 8 sticks of blue. It's just blue.
But they're all solids, though. There are no shades variations within that, are there?
Well, there's always going to be shade variation.
No,
they're more like intensity differences.
Yeah.
That create a perceived change in shade. But in actuality, all of this is a difference in intensity.
Okay.
So it gives you something to work with.
Ultramarine, dark ultramarine.
Well, there's a perfect example.
Those what should have colors, different.
Jeff and me talk about this, and Tom and me. Mm-hmm. What color is lake?
Oh, I was going to say that. Thank you.
Like a magenta.
Not
the color of Steve's shirt, if you could see it.
No, it's not. No,
that's ultramarine.
This is close to electric blue, but not.
No, Jeff.
Lake is not blue, and it's annoying.
But it does have an aura of blue or violet in it.
It's a nice burgundy.
You want to know? Okay.
See, I know what burgundy is better than I do lake.
So here, lake.
I know.
Lake is.
That's not what I meant.
I know lake.
Well, I'm the one who said Cabernet.
Yeah, Tom.
And you tipped your glass.
And lake.
This stamp has a bad bouquet.
Somebody defined somewhere what lake is. But lake isn't even a color. Lake is a shade.
Lake is a shade, and from various issues, they are not the same.
Yeah, well,
then it shouldn't be used as a color to describe the stamp.
Correct.
Yeah. It's a shade of what?
When I first started, and I saw the term carmine lake, what the crap color is that?
And the other thing is that it's backwards.
Is that English?
The first word is supposed to be the shade. The second word is the color. So when you have orange brown, you've got a brown stamp. When you have blackish green, you've got a green stamp.
I thought it was opposite.
No.
The first color is the predominant.
No. No, the first color is the shade.
That makes more sense. So when you not the way it is.
So when you have Carmen Lake, you should have Lake Carmen.
What color is a 4-cent Washington stamp? It's brown. In the catalog, it calls it yellow brown.
I call it light brown.
Light brown, yellow brown is the predominant color.
But you wouldn't call it brown light.
But you wouldn't call it brown yellow.
Or you wouldn't call
it not one I can see.
Brown dark.
Well, taking the, you know, you want color varieties, taking the 70 and 78 series, you know, steel blue. Steel's not the color.
The stamp
is blue.
And the shade is steel.
Once again,
I didn't name it.
I have not seen the Ridgeway yet. Steve is going to bring it over to my house on Tuesday, but I am going to bet you money that Ridgeway has somewhere in there a steel colored feather.
Oh,
I
bother.
Think of the steel blue as gun blue.
Gunmetal blue.
For the true steel blue shade.
Which is very rare.
Very rare.
Well, and again, that's something that people should be aware of, is that when you're looking in the catalog, and I, again, you know, because of what I collect, we have a orange-brown which is Scott's number 10 and 10A. And then you have an orange red, which is number 11 and 11A. And so people look at the first word, which is orange, and the orange red stamp does look orange. And they call it a number 10, not realizing that that second word is it. It's not, number 10 is not an orange brown. It's not an orange stamp. It's a brown stamp. And so you need to be aware that the first word is the shade. And that's, again, where a lot of these colors get messed up, is because Scott's catalog in some cases does switch them.
It's inconsistent.
Yeah, it's inconsistent.
That's where...
So, well, like we said, you know, Carmen Lake. And it's actually Lake is a shade. It should be Lake Carmen, but then everybody, I think, would want to look it up on a map somewhere.
But I've been there.
Is that good, somewhere in Ohio?
How about Prussian Blue?
Prussian Blue, yeah.
Prussian is it to blue. Come from Prussia?
originally? From?
Well, yeah. Originally.
That's a nice.
That's a history thing, but the blue pigments came from Germany because they were chemical created after the Industrial Revolution. And a lot of the inks had problems during World War I and World War II because of the blueness, where they got the blue ink from.
So it's like with the paper, too, the bluish paper.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's another good one. That paper is not blue.
That's a topic for another discussion.
Yeah, next time let's do blue paper.
Which isn't blue.
Okay, so what are the chances that someone has the one in a million real quick?
I think that if a million people listen to this podcast, one of them will have a stamp.
Oh, wait, what about that guess the number thing?
Oh, yeah, everybody who's listening right now, close your eyes and think of a number between 1 and 100. Is everybody thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, here we go. 47.
Ta-da!
See, now, everybody is going, 99% of you are going to be going, what the hell was that? But 1% of you out there, they're going to be going, holy crap, that guy is a magician. And, of course, I am.
And he is.
Are we going to open up a C3?
Oh!
Or do we have time?
Our new weekly thing.
Surprise.
Uh-oh.
Oh. Yes. We're going to play the inverted Jenny lottery. And we are going to open up
the C3A development
sheet.
And we're going to do this until we all become millionaires.
Yeah. All right. Now this one
as
is
he trims out the
drum
cellophane
roll.
Envelope.
There has to be a drum roll.
Oh, there he is.
Oh. Oh, guess it's not the invert.
Don't bend it while you're opening it.
And it is
a winner.
A normal. Hold on, I have one of those. I don't know where it is.
Get the shirt.
No, that's not it.
That's what we're doing while you're looking for it.
Well,
there you go.
That's appropriate. And Danny's looking at us like, y'all are crazy.
We are. Prerequisite.
And we'll just keep opening them at the end of every episode now until we find it, huh?
That's it.
How many of those do we have?
I got about 70 of them.
Oh, good
you
Lord.
Have 70?
Yeah, I think so.
Oh.
Thank you for listening to us yet again. You can email us at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com with your questions and comments. And as always, you can keep the conversation going online at stampshowheretoday at Facebook and stampshowheret at Twitter. So as always, keep collecting.
I'm Brian Metz with OCStampStore.com with your stamp tip of the week. When you're looking at your 1 cent 1851 to 57 issue and you've eliminated type 2, type 4, and type 5, take a look at the top and the bottom of your stamp. Look at the top center above POS of postage or the bottom center below E space CE of 1 cent. If you see a break in the top and the bottom, it is a type 3. Now, the difference between a type 3 and a type 3A is a type 3 will have a break at both the top and the bottom. The type 3A will only have a break at either the top or the bottom. For more U.S. stamp tips, sign up for my newsletter at ocstampstore.com.
This is Bill Jansen. I'm the Youth Committee Chairman at SESCAL, and there's a stamp show here today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.